Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the African American Studies channel at the New Books Network. My name is Brittany Edmonds, and I'm very happy to welcome Professor Jafari S. Allen to the show today. He's here to discuss his newest book, There's a Disco Ball Between Us, A Theory of Black Gay Life. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Brittany. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I wonder if we could start by you just telling us a bit about your book. And I'm especially curious about your subtitle, A Theory of Black Gay Life. So can you tell us, you know, what you're going for with this book, and especially that kind of ambitious subtitle, Theory of Black Gay Life?
Right. Yeah, it is. It is ambitious. The book has gone through a few different subtitles. Well, from no subtitle to two different subtitles that I can remember. And we owe this ambition, or, you know, grandiose ambition, maybe, to Robert Redfar, who suggested, after reading a version of it, that what I had written was a theory of Black gay life. And it resonated with me because it was actually my ambition to write a theory. So, and it's very important to note that, you know, I'm joking about the grandiose nature of this, because a theory is to say that this is one way of thinking through Black gay life systematically, and through one perspective, one, you know, learned perspective, I think, and experienced perspective, but one perspective. And what I found after writing and after reading what ended up on the page was that far from my first ambition to write sort of sets of case studies of life of Black LGBTQIA folks in particular places and perhaps times, that what happened was looked more like one of the past subtitles was an ethnography of an idea. And so it looked more like thinking through the idea. The idea is Black gay. And what we have here is a way to think through Black gay life. And I wanted to de-emphasize the ethnography part for a moment to broaden this out, so that audiences could make their way into this on their own terms and not necessarily on the terms of what people understand as a disciplinary or an academic framework or concept.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so much richness in that answer. And when I called your subtitle ambitious, I meant it in a good way. I actually think your book is quite capacious. And in preparation for this interview, you know, usually my interviews are very structured and I kind of march forward through the book, hitting on all the points across the author's chapters. And as I was preparing for this one, I was like, oh, well, you're going to need a different approach, right? my interest in the subtitle also has to do with some things you just said in response to that first question. Like, I'm curious about the use of the word theory, and you kind of sort of parse that as one way of thinking through Black gay life systematically. And I was really interested in that word simply because of all the theoretical work you do around sort of systematized thinking in the monograph itself. And so I have a question about that. But then I'm also very curious about Black gay, you know, that as a formulation to capture what's being described in this book. And of course, you know, we're gonna dig into your chapters where you're actually sort of interrogating that formation. But I wonder if you could say something about, you know, theory in that subtitle, and then also Black gay, and how both of those things might be important to the different kinds of boundary pushing you're doing in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question. That's a really sensitive question that you see. I think you see what we're here. The Black gay part is, in fact, and I think, you know, I do subtly argue that in the beginning, that what we may have lost in the translation from Black gay to Black queer, or gay to queer, or from gay Black queer, or other sorts of names people have for how they live and love and think. And so with Black gay, I'm trying to specifically talk about and begin in the long 1980s when the term Black gay emerges. And importantly, it emerges alongside gay Black. And, you know, we get into a bit of the controversy, Black gay versus gay Black, which has more to do with people's feelings than grammar. But wanted to specifically that moment as a time in which lots of groups that have begun to differentiate or think about their specific naming apart from gay. So, for example, in Black gay includes Black gay women. Which would be who also many times call themselves lesbians, but not always, right? Black gay men, trans folks, gender non-conforming folks, who at that time may have called themselves transsexual or transvestite or simply gay. And it is important to note at least two things with this, with the slippage in the language or the movement of the language, that we can look at Black gay as an aspiration of one community in which we understand ourselves, and by ourselves I mean lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans folks, and queer now folks, as one community. And that we understand that we need to be at the edge of each other's battles, and that we are fluent in each other's histories, et cetera, et cetera. We know historically that that was not always the case. And one of the reasons that it was important for Black women to specifically name themselves Black lesbian with a capital L is because of attempts at erasure and the same sorts of politics of asking women to put their politics on hold, or not recognizing the other members of the community, Black gay men, not recognizing their leadership, perhaps. And of course, the biggest example that we can see in recent years is the need for gender nonconforming transgender trans folks to specifically name, in order to have the issues clearer and to have those of us who are cisgender gay folks understand that we also operate out of privileges that must be at least interrogated, if not denied and leveraged for the sake of our sisters and brothers and siblings who prefer not to be named by their gender. So the Black gay part tries to do some of that work. Life, you didn't mention life, but life is very important there, because life in there is about living. That this theory is not about, there's certainly lots of literature here and philosophy and et cetera, but what we're interested in is Black gay folks living and having full lives that have materiality, right? People have bodies, people have, I would say, souls, we can argue that, people have spirits, people have needs, and all of that is in here. It's not sort of an extracted and abstract sort of way of thinking about Black gay. And so the theory is also important here, because I want to valorize and validate forms of theory that are not translated from the French, or that, you know, do not depend upon authorized theorists with a big T, even though there are a couple of them in here, right? At least in my thinking. But the theory of Black gay life and the aspiration to offer a theory of Black gay life is also to say that by thinking through how Black gay folks lived their lives and lived their lives, we can see the patterns that will show us the theory. So it's not Jafari who is theorizing, or it's not only me theorizing, but this is a chronicle of Black gay folks theorizing.
Yeah, no, that's great. It will help. You said it, by looking at the patterns in Black gay life, you know, it will show us this sort of theory. I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. It helps us sort of transition to thinking about my next question, which is just how your book begins, right? You sort of announced that it's going to be a social affair, and one in which you are going to be engaging in a certain kind of rigorous thought alongside people you've been thinking with for decades now. And that's marked across your monograph by, you know, you using the first name of theorists, scholars, culture workers of all kinds. And so I wonder, just sort of thinking about, you know, perhaps the book is a sort of enactment of the Black gay life that's also sort of being theorized, showcased, validated, valorized. I wonder if you could say what that means in relationship to your disciplinary homes. I know you have multiple. But also to, you know, maybe that sort of discarded past title, which was an ethnography of an idea, right? I mean, you said that a part of what you wanted to do with this book was to sort of de-emphasize ethnography. So I'm curious about what Black gay life has to tell us as it sort of manifests in the academy, in the institution, you know, in the form of this book, right? This book will circulate right. In ways that maybe is a bit different than some of the people who are profiled in your book. And so I wonder if you could maybe speak to what that means to you as someone of many disciplinary homes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So many, many disciplinary homes. And one of the things that I wanted to do here was to not dishonor any one of those disciplinary homes, right? So, you know, I have, you know, a doctoral degree in anthropology, right? And did it at a time and a place where those of us who were being trained understood that we were being trained to be social theorists. And that meant at that time a certain investment in especially French social theory at that time, right? And it also meant learning, at least for me, not everyone at my institution, because it was unpopular, but my advisor at least was a dedicated ethnographer, right? So there's the Goetzian understanding of doing deep and close, thick ethnography, but at the same time, I want in this work and in all my work to be honest about the disciplinary homes that actually brought me to do this work, right? And that was being a community member and a volunteer at GMAD, Gay Men of African Descent, learning from people like Kevin Magruder and Colin Robinson, who I mentioned in the book, and working at the Audre Lorde Center, and actually being able to witness the foundation of that organization and witness how Kathy Cohen and Jackie Alexander were so key, crucial to that process. And so the discipline, right, the discipline watching and working with colleagues and coworkers and friends like those is just as important, or if not actually more important. And so what are some of those tools and disciplines? These are the questions that I had to ask. And then thinking about those who had documented Black gay life from the long 1980s, I think especially of Marlon Riggs, right? So Marlon says in Tongues Untied that he's interested in anthropology, in an anthropology of what is, he defines anthropology as anthropology, the search for what is utterly precious. So the moment that I begin to reflect on the discipline and the way to think through these issues, I come to understand that even though my formal academic training may be in one area or several areas, feminist studies, Black studies, etc., that notion of the search for what is utterly precious, and a Salto Saints notion, or not notion, but a mandate to all of us to do our best work to create legacies and to create testaments, right? This understanding from Melvin Dixon that those of us who are on this earth and healthy must remember and must call the names of those who have gone before. It occurs to me, and it occurred to me during writing of this work, that is the sort of the highest discipline that I needed to pay attention to and that I needed to honor in this work. And I find that in so doing, that what I'm actually doing also is contributing to the long Black intellectual tradition, right? So Manning Marable talked about three different positions, right? That is, the work must be corrective of work that has gone before that may have been racist or heterosexist, misogynist, just wrong. It should be descriptive of what Black folks are doing from our own perspectives, and it should be prescriptive. That is, it should give a vision for what should happen. And I think that that the discipline of, I wonder, is Black gay a discipline? I call it a habit of mind, but we can also think of this as a discipline, right? That the way that the folks that I talk about in this work, in the beginning of this work from the long 1980s, taught us to work, the ways that they taught us to work, allows us to do Black studies in a really relevant and fresh way that is also centrally located in the best of that long tradition.
Yeah, no, you know, in your answer, you touched on so many parts of the book that I'm sort of anxious to dig into. But I wonder just quickly, I liked your mischievous look when you said, you know, Black gay is a habit of mind, not a discipline. So I just want to note that. But the thing I'm curious about is, like, do you want this book to land in anthropology? Do you care how it's received by other anthropologists? Do you think it does something that anthropologists need to be aware of. And I mean that both at the level of methodology, at the level of how it's, how the work is presented. That's where we're going to go next, because I'm anxious to talk about chapter three, which you brought up by, you know, name checking GMAT and also sort of Marlin and others. But I just, I wonder, I'm just, it's my own curiosity. If you, I don't know if you have any designs on anthropology, because I agree with you that this book firmly fits into a Black intellectual tradition. So,
You know, I would have said, so one of the things that I'm finishing right now, and it's overdue, is a chapter in a book called Queer Anthropology, that is being edited by my colleague, Margot Weiss. And it's called something like, the search for what is utterly precious and the ends of anthropology. And what I try to do in that essay is care about what anthropology, care about extracting for anthropologists what they ought to look for in this book and other works, because I think that it will be helpful for all of us, for example, to think through how some of the work of Audre Lorde, for example, Kathy Cohen, M. Jackie Alexander, can point anthropologists to ways to do their work better. And I also want to make it clear that this work exists and has a life and circulates without anthropology. I want to say irregardless, right? Because I want to make the point by being by using that word that's not a word but is a word in African-American vernacular English, because to answer your question plainly, as I was writing about this, no, I did not think about anthropology, and I think that it may work better that way for anthropology and anthropologists if those of us who have some way of doing our work that can be useful just do that work without having to translate it, without making it completely legible, because it is in doing the work of understanding. So I'll just say that I think it works. It would works for anthropologists, and that I make this case in the essay that while since the 1980s, feminists, queer scholars, and many black scholars have tried to follow Faye Harrison in this really noble mission of decolonizing anthropology, and constantly critiquing anthropology and having come to Jesus moments with important essays, you know, every year. My friend and former student just wrote, Ryan Jobson just wrote a piece last year in which he suggests that we might just let it burn, right? That is to say that we ought to think about allowing some of us simply to do our work and not being constantly burdened with explaining things to anthropology and fitting things in an anthropological frame.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I really like that answer. So thank you. I wonder if we can think about, I want to go to chapter three, just because you brought it up and it was one of my favorite chapters. It's called Other Countries. And in it, you weave so many different aspects of the long 1980s together, but then also sort of your own experience teaching about this sort of moment, which you call the Black A classical period. So you also sort of weave in your own sort of pedagogical accounts of teaching about sort of major figures. And so my first question about this sort of chapter is if you could talk about just the fluidity across the chapter, like how it is the movement within your chapters always struck me as just sort of fascinating and wonderfully productive. But then also the sort of complicated histories you're excavating, where you're thinking about these questions of Black masculinity. You're also thinking about questions of interracial desire. And you're also thinking about what it means to have these figures who serve these sort of central purposes, who occupy such a great space in sort of Black gay formation for all kinds of people, right? You call yourself as looking up to Joseph Bean, et cetera, and your own students are looking to these figures for some kind of guidance, but for them to also maybe resist that in certain ways. And so that's a lot there, but I guess I'm curious about your willingness to sit with these questions that are elicited by major figures within the movement, and also your willingness to talk about how those questions that you bring up refract across many periods, including your own personal history and in that of your students.
Right. So thank you. Yeah, I'm glad that you found the the movement between these time and spaces productive. They are both reflections, some of them reflections and refractions, and there are huge time periods perhaps between one section to the other, and sometimes thematic changes. And certainly in one section there may be literature and autoethnography and some social theory, etc. But it was purposeful to give that sense of the here, the yesterday in today and the here and now, and to really reflect the way not only I see us living, but the way that I try to impart this to my students and to younger Black gay or Black queer folks. It was difficult also because without this chapter, it might have been a little easier, right? That is, it might have been easier to abstract or to think at an arm's length about these figures, about these time periods, about these works. But I couldn't because they are so formative. They're so formative to my own intellectual and political lens, and also formative to the habit of mind that I try to talk about and the lenses of folks that I know and love. And so, you know, the questions of masculine performance, of interracial and intraracial desire, and our ongoing conversations about that were sometimes difficult to write about, but I thought extremely important to lay out, and to lay out through some of the important figures, not only what they had to say about those issues, but also how they lived their lives.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I guess, you know, as you're speaking, I'm also in that chapter, you know, I was struck by a number of things, but first I'll say there's a great deal of, you don't quite call it recovery, and I'm not sure recovery is necessarily the right word, but there's a lot of just material, like Black, gay, cultural production in your book. And a lot of it is stuff that I didn't know about or I knew about partially. So in that chapter, you have this figure name, and I hope I'm saying this correctly, but Soto Saint?
Soto Saint, mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, you talk about this work of Soto Saints that has been sort of anthologized in multiple places, but always abridged. And so I wonder if we could use Soto Saint to think about how voluminous it seems the archive is for Black gay life, right? I mean, your book is sort of teeming with all of these moments that I did not necessarily know about, but also how it seems like the same moments keep popping up. And so you consider this by way of Melvin Dixon, but I wonder if you could just, I don't know, reflect on that weird part of the archive and what that means for writing a book like this, or even for that chapter and your inclusion of your own personal experiences within the book.
Right. Yeah, you know, I was really struck by the fact that Hosato's really important essay that had been abridged, that had been added to or included in two very important anthologies, was abridged. I didn't know it was abridged until I read an article by a colleague, Andia Billy, and her footnote indicated where I could find the original. And I talked with her, and it was really a revelation to see that there was so much more in this essay than had been published before. And so, you know, that has a lot to say about editorial choices and about the archive. And in this book, there are moments. So to add us, you know, to add Hosato is not earth shattering, right? He's clearly one of the most important figures. Yet, as I argue here, I don't know that he is always put to the best use critically, or that the archive is teased out enough. And, you know, my job in this book, I didn't set out to, you know, to give a comprehensive view of any one of the figures, but it's gratifying for me to hear that you found things that you hadn't seen before and other things that you had seen before you see repeated, because like any habit of mind, like any discipline, like any tradition or canon, if you will, there are individuals and works that we return to over and over again. And at the same time, with our archives, there are still works and individuals yet to be discovered. There are works by important individuals that have not been fully researched. There are figures who were at the perhaps at the periphery of the places we know well, like Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles. But then there's a whole, just in this country, there's a whole middle of the country, or excepting Chicago, right? We know some figures in Chicago, but there's so much more to know. And this notion of Hosato and being more than the Hosato we know, but also Yves-François Lubin, like his actual government name, right? As someone who migrated here from Haiti, is important in the 1970s, is important to sit with. And then when we get to another piece, for example, I'm looking now for the poem that I reprinted here, because the book is out of print. But to think about our Black Gay Renaissance, as folks have called it, and not be able to then call up Adrian, right? So this Yeah Baby, that one poem, really theorizes interracial desire in a way that we don't often see it. We don't often see it talked about, right? So there's humor in here, there's tongue in cheek, there's also, you know, some very strong indictments both ways. It's really so smart, right? And so it was important for me to add works like this so that we can see, again, the theory of it. It's not me theorizing, right, that the author, the poet, has also already theorized this. And then that goes the same for talking through, or for me, rethinking small or short films here, right, that had not been talked about before in academic work. And so you use the word recover before. I don't know, and you know, we neither of us know whether this is like really recovery, right? But it was important for me to have at least this acknowledgement, and this even if it is a provocation for other people to think about these works in ways that they hadn't been thought about them before, or to go out and find those works, right? And to look at them themselves and find out what else is there in the archive.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about, you know, and sort of looking back through the book as well, you know, what feels so special about reading through your chapters. And I'm still trying to process why maybe this third chapter, which we're talking about right now, but really what we're saying stretches across the book, but why that third chapter strikes me so intensely. And I think it's curation is what, you know, seems very special about your book. It's the way that you're bringing up things, sort of putting them in conversation with each other. But also there's a lack sometimes, and I mean this in a good way, of a kind of resolute critical comment, right? And so one of the things that I think is very sort of unique about this book, and I wonder if you'll speak to this just for a bit, is, I mean, you show Black gay life through its conflicts. I mean, you even feature moments where people are arguing with you on Facebook about, you know, your own embeddedness in the neoliberal academy. And so, I mean, I think a part of what felt so special about this book is just the sort of texture of life that you're able to tap into. And as much as you're sort of remarking upon various forms of precarity, right? I mean, AIDS is always at the backdrop of this book. What's really at the fore is Black life, right? Is Black gay life. And so I just wonder if you could talk about that maybe in relation to the archive, because I also remember sort of reading that question, like, why not Joe? You know, why not Melvin? And those questions just sat with me, like, okay, maybe the problem isn't always that there aren't archives. Sometimes the problem is that we're not even looking at what's in the archive. You know, right. we just keep repeating that there aren't archives. And so I know I just said a lot, but I wonder that decision to curate. I wonder if you could speak to that maybe in relationship to the archive, in relationship to these figures who we want to pin down and make into idols of a kind. And repeatedly you show that that doesn't quite work. Like, maybe the lesson that you should take from this is not that. I mean, that seems what it comes to be for your students, at least. You're like, well, maybe you're asking the wrong questions about these figures, you know?
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that. Because it's that, so, you know, one of the first things, right, there are archives, right? And there are, you know, there are living people who can tell you stories from their own perspectives, right? There even, you know, we don't even have to go to archives. There are books that are well in print that folks have just not thought about enough. But you know, when I hear you talk about the curation, a few things come to mind. One is that that may be an anthropological disciplinary thing that that I resist. I don't want to make one critical comment about one figure or one text or work to stand in for an entire period or concept, right? I want the texture of the social action, right? And that takes several different characters, right, in your narrative. So maybe that's one thing I can, you know, I can give to anthropology and say, you know, thank you for anthropological training. But then I can come back and say that that's also about, you know, it's also about a sort of observation and storytelling that I learned from learned at home. But the other concept that one of the concepts that operates here is the concept of the anthological. And I think that what I was thinking about in every chapter and in every section of the book is having it all be multivocal. And if there are important important dissonances, if there are important arguments, then they let them come, right? Because we learn through those, and we also learn that dissonance or disconnect or difference of opinion does not mean that we abandon one another. It does not mean that we don't continue conversation. It doesn't mean that we are not kin. And so this is what I've tried to do here. And one of the things that I also learned myself as a member of the community and as a member of organizations where you know where one where two or more Black gay folks are gathered, there will be conflama also, right? There will be, you know, there will be stuff that's going to be fabulous and lovely and sparkles and unicorns, but there's also going to be some shades, going to be some differences of opinion, and we ought to learn better ways to work through that. So I think that I tried to give that sense of the anthological that various people have various ways of seeing things, and to be upfront with my dear reader about where I stand, so that I'm not trying to be slick and run anything by people. My feelings and my position is going to be clear, but it's also going to be clear that this is not everybody's position, and that my position doesn't always work really very well. For me, right? And so learn. The dedication of the book, you know, to the children, right, is honest that I want people, I want, you know, my students and I want younger queer folks or Black gay folks to sit with this and to learn about being in community.
Yeah, you know, and I'm so happy you brought up the anthological element of your book because I wanted to ask about it, right? I mean, because anthological shows up both, you know, you're sort of describing a tradition, a generation of folks, but you're also using it yourself as a kind of, what's the word? Maybe conceptual heuristic, a way of organizing your ideas. And so I wonder if you could speak to just, you know, for folks who haven't read the book, if you could just sort of say more about the ontological. Because I will say one more thing that, you know, when I first read that, I realized, like, yes, the main ways that I've come to know Black gay life have been through anthologies. Like, that's just true. You know, that's in the academy, that's sort of outside of the academy. Yeah, if I'm reading, even if I'm watching something, I mean, many of the filmmakers have a very like collages sort of approach right. to their work. And so, yeah, I was really, to me, that was sort of, it opened up a lot.
Yes, I think that's really key. So the anthological is one, you know, one way, as you say, is the way that I've chosen to think through having multiple voices and organizing those voices and presenting those voices in this work, knowing and admitting that I am the one choosing and curating like an editor does. So this is not, it's not completely democratic. It's not a free for all. It's selected for a specific reason, just like anthologies are. But as a historic marker and a marker of intellectual history, I thought it really important also to note what you just said, that this is, when we think of the major works, the beginning of Black gay studies, they come out of anthologies and journals, and this is the way that much of this work was done. And that's important for a number of reasons. One is to go back to your question about academic disciplines and the constraints of those disciplines, what we are asked to produce in those disciplines, right? So for example, as a social cultural anthropologist, I'm asked to produce a monograph, right? Mono meaning just me, right? And that is the coin of the realm. What would it be if I was asked to, and if the academy really valued collaborative work? How much better would this work be if I, you know, did this work with Kevin Kwashi and Omi Shaikh Tinsley and Kathy Cohen? Could you imagine, right? But that's, you know, that's not what we're asked to do as professional academics. But this is what this is one of the things that Barbara Smith and Beverly Smith and the other women of color in Kitchen Table Press were doing. This is some of the work that that both Essex and Joe were doing in The Life and in Brother to Brother. It's some of the work that Joe did in editing Outlook. And it's difficult. It's difficult work, and it is work that in which we have to be really sensitive to other people's voices. We also agree upon what the point of the anthology is, what statement we are trying to make, but understanding that people are making those statements in various ways. Right, and that we are richer for that, we are richer for that array of voices, and so I wanted to point that out and to honor that, to get us to think about what it is we get when we can take an anthology and flip in an anthology like, you know, The Black Woman, right, which is not a queer anthology, but the anthology that Tony K. Bambara edited, and you can flip and have for example Abby Lincoln on one page, and then a group of socialist workers from upstate New York on another page. That is, you have not just one understanding of the Black woman, but you sort of betray the lie of that title, or the conceit of that title, the Black woman, by showing lots of different Black women.
Yeah, no, I love it. You can see all these like different things happening at the same time, right? It's just, I love that, yeah, that idea, the anthological. I guess I'm curious about then how you would describe the differences between the two parts of your book, and the third part's the conclusion, but the two parts, which is the anthological generation, and then the second part is, let me find it, bonds and disciplines.
So bonds and disciplines,
about,
right.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. And then I also just wanted to remark, you know, you were talking about how difficult anthological work is, curational work is. And I wanted to just see if you wanted to say more about that in relationship to the Black Queer Diaspora Working Group Symposium, and also the sort of subsequent journal issue, just because you, in that, I mean, I was really struck by how vulnerable, and this happens across the book, but you were willing to say, look, I have regrets. I had regrets in relationship to how that working group, how that sort of journal issue came to be, how it eventually made it, found itself in the world. And so those are my two questions. Yeah.
Right. You specialize in the hard questions, right? So that second part, that Black Queerpolis, is meant to be, you know, after we move out of the long 1980s, here we are, where we have something called Black Queer Studies, right? And you know, what are we going to do with it? And what is it? What are the lessons we can draw from that earlier period, that nascent period, for now? How are these period, how are they alike and how are they different, right? And yes, I mentioned that anthological work is difficult. That is, it is difficult whether you are actually, you know, doing an anthology or a journal article, or whether you're trying to just think anthologically, think collaboratively. Because as I said, in the realm where we find ourselves in the academy, that is not what is, that's not what is expected, and certainly not what is rewarded. And so, like the third chapter, you know, I guess I thought, you know, if I'm going to talk about, you know, my romantic failures, right, you know, I might as well talk about professional failures or professional missteps, or so that somebody can learn from them, right? And also, I think, because, you know, speaking of that that Black Queer Diaspora issue that we're, you know, extremely proud of, I think that it's that some of it, especially, you know, my introduction may get misread when I talk about the social erotics of love, may get misread as if, you know, all of us, you know, are girls together all the time, and we're just holding hands and, you know, skipping through fields, and that it's all easy. And I wanted to, and felt that it was necessary for me to tell more of the truth, so that people can see that that's not, I didn't say that it was easy, and I didn't say that that there weren't barriers. And so this is why we call it bonds, because, you know, your bonds and disciplines, because there are personal, intimate bonds between many of us as colleagues and as friends. Yet we come from various different disciplines, and with different ideas about whether we're making a discipline together, right? And so I wanted to do what Barbara Christian asked us to do. So that chapter begins with an epigram where she says, what do we think we are doing anyway? And Dr. Christian is always, I mean, her titles are always fixing, right? And she says, I begin my reflection on the state of Black feminist criticism with this memory, because it seems to me we so quickly forget the recent past, right? And so I didn't want us to forget the recent past. because that moment of nascence has so quickly turned into something else, and just very quickly, right? And so I thought it was important to chronicle that and to narrate it, and to narrate it in a way, certainly where I'm not the only voice. So that piece that that comes directly out of our time together is extremely important, that it be the voices of those individuals, so that people can see and hear the fact that we don't use the same vocabulary, the that we don't address each other in the same way, that we have some important agreements and some important disagreements, and for me to be honest and not try to discipline, you know, my friends and colleagues here into, everyone into one paragraph, right, of summary, but to have the richness of our conversation rendered fully, right, and in real time of the occurrence.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, and thank you for your graciousness. I realize I mentioned the title of the first and second part of your book incorrectly, and so I will correct myself now. Part one is A Stitch in Space-Time, the Long 1980s, and part two is Black Queer Polis. And I wonder, you know, after your gloss there, if you think about this as sort of crudely being, and this is very crude, kind of Black gay life pre and post institutionalization, and if that crude kind of, you know, marking works, I wonder how you would narrate maybe the differences across those two moments. But then I'm also kind of curious about, I guess I'm curious about our moment now, which is somewhat in that part too. But I wonder what you think about the conversations we're having about Black gay life right now. You know what I mean? In relationship, maybe to how they're sketched in these two parts, because for me, I find that, I don't know, very sort of immediate questions about precarity have become incredibly vague. You know, I was struck in your book while you give us the numbers. You're like, no, like, you know, one in two Black men, you know, you give us the actual percentage of how many men have AIDS, for example, right? In a given moment in time, how many folks are living in various kinds of conditions. And I just wonder what you think about that in relationship to our current moment, our current discourse.
I made a decision in the last sort of revision not to like do a and now today sort of thing. And I realized, you know, and I had good intellectual reasons for that at the time, but I realized in talking with you that I didn't want to come off as, you know, the doddering old guy who's like, you know, y'all kids are doing it all wrong. Why, you know, you fucking up here and blah, blah, blah. And so, but as I read the last iteration, I realized that it's here without my having, like a lot of things in this book, like, without my having to say explicitly, it's here. And some of it is in the letter, like in this chapter in Bonds and Discipline, the letters that Omi Shaikh Tinsley and I write together. Yes. And she goes there, right? And she goes there by saying, you know, everything was so promising when we were beginning assistant professors, and this is what was happening. And now that has changed. Right. So she's talking about institutional constraints. Right. She's talking about the political moment changing there. But I think that she's also and then I also want to point to the intellectual stakes there. Right. And so when you talk about conditions, I think that, you know, that I am ready to say, you know, and, you know, let's have this conversation with folks. The really My attitude is let a thousand flowers bloom, that we need all sorts of work from every discipline, from every habit of mind. We need to all be in conversation. And at the same time, I think that, I think that what I see reading some newer works is a willingness to shift from material conditions to really erudite in many cases, and in many cases, beautifully written meditations that that may be great on their own, and at the same time, I wouldn't want to see everybody do their work that way, right? And I also realized reading the conversation that this comes up in the conversation at the end of Bonds and Discipline. We're having a conversation about interacting notions and analogs between Black and Black lowercase and black with a big B and people of color, et cetera, reconciling contradictions, et cetera, and in the Q&A, Calvin Warren, who was a graduate student at Yale at that time, asks a question about subtle distinctions between materiality and the literary or the metaphorical. And Michelle responds in a really, and I was struck by how beautifully and how succinctly she was able to respond. Not surprised because she is not always brilliant, but surprised that in that moment it came so quickly, right? And so she says the object that stands outside Black queer discourse is the same one that stands outside of almost all discourses, and that is the body, right? So here she is pointing us to the materiality of the body and the need to think through discourses and archival materials relevant to and in reference to our corporeal selves, right? And then Lyndon says, so precisely the place where the physical fails, where language fails, where there's an inability to talk about something that is not material, the metalinguistic perhaps, he talks about the metaphysical and then brings Audre Lorde and M. Jackie Alexander into the frame, right? So here, what happens without my, so this is not my writing this, this happened just the way that it is written here. I didn't move anything around, but the conversation is one, the end of this conversation is where I would pick up what you're asking now, right? To say that the importance of our material selves, our material needs, and the importance of the metaphysical needs, the connections to each other, the connections to spirit, the connections that we can't see, are things that I'd like us to think about more and do more work on, right? And that both of these require deeper engagement with the archives that we know and pushing those boundaries and also collecting new archives, new data, so that we're learning new things rather than constantly celebrating I'll leave it at that. Yes.
You know, I feel like I know what you want to say, and I kind of want to push you there, but I think it might be related to your comment earlier about, you know, every time I sit down to write, I don't want to have to say, like, this is how I fit into anthropology. And it does seem like a lot of work today is geared toward celebrating the fact of our lives as in and of themselves transgressive or theoretically productive, rather than the fact of our lives as sort of material beings who, like you say, need things in the world, including each other.
Right.
So I don't know.
If and I'll answer last... this way. So I appreciate you being polite and not pushing me there. But I'll say it this way, that you know, I understand and have understood for a long time that many people regard anthropologists, you know, and other social scientists as flat-footed and you know, just tell us the story, just describe it, and you know, and go away. That may be seen as less sophisticated than other sorts of work that that requires and is in a that requires engagement with high theory and continental philosophy, for example, right? And of course, a lot of anthropologists do this, right? But I'm saying this just to say that work is still important, right? That a description of our lives is still important, that a close reading of our works is still important, and that if done right, the sophistication of the theorization is going to be right there because, and again, Professor Christian told us, you know, my people are a race for theory, that you're going to, the moment that you sit down in a room of Black people and begin listening and recording, you are going to find really dense theorization, right? We don't necessarily need to refer to only European disciplines and their greatest hits in order to justify our work. And that said, as someone who is clearly very interested in some of that, right? But you should find those folks in the notes, not up front.
I think that's a great note to end on. So thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. I thank you for reading so generously and so deeply, and for the conversation. Thanks so much, Brittany.